This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's a place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street. Well, welcome, folks. Dr. Charles Parker, one more time, and we have another very, very interesting guest for you. This is going to really take our brains in a completely different place, a constructive place, one of the many constructive places that we've been. But this is about brain health through your life. And our guest today is Dr. Michelle. It's pronounced Brown, but it's phonetically Braun. Dr. Braun, thank you so much for coming on board. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So what we're going to be talking about is brain health, and we're going to be talking about the issue of aging. She's going to talk a little bit about, get this, folks, fasten your seatbelts, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It will be your friend by the time we finish talking. And in addition, she has a quiz that's going to be a PDF download, a brain health quiz. By the time we get done, you're going to want to run in there and pick that puppy up, because it's going to be helpful for you. So let me introduce Michelle for a moment. Dr. Michelle Braun is a Yale Harvard-trained board-certified neuropsychologist, we'll talk about that in a minute, and a brain health expert from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She is passionate about empowering individuals to boost brain health and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. And she's been featured on PBS, Fox TV, and in the print media. Dr. Braun previously served as the Assistant Director of Inpatient Mental Health at the Boston VA and as an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She is here to share inspiring information about how to improve memory and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's by, get this, folks, creating a high-octane brain. Who is not going to be interested in that one? So, Michelle, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are now, what you're doing, and give us a little bit of background on who we're talking to.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm so honored to be here. I am in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is my hometown. And as you mentioned, I did some studying out on the East Coast as I was getting enraptured by the field of neuropsychology and really wanting to apply that as much as possible. And then moved back here, back in 2011, actually, to settle down. And I really started this journey in interest in brain health back in my teenage years. I remember very clearly being about 14 years old and going to visit my great aunt at a nursing home. And on my way to her room, I was just taken aback and literally stopped in my footsteps as I saw, unfortunately, about three or four of the residents there in wheelchairs who were facing the wall. And I thought, okay, maybe that's just a break in the action. Maybe they're in the midst of going outside or something. But when I came out of her room, my great aunt's room, about an hour or two later, they were still in the same position. And that was just a heart-wrenching moment for me. And not only had me thinking about, gosh, what are these people missing by that lack of interaction and that lack of engagement, but what are we missing? I feel like the national treasure of the elder wisdom, so to speak, was just being seeped. And so that got me really interested in working with older adults and thinking about what the needs are of that group in particular. And then about 3 years later, a family friend was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And it was a shock to all of us because he was an attorney. He was somebody who was so active in the community, a brilliant mind, a compassionate soul. And over the span of a few years, ended up, unfortunately, being unable to communicate in a meaningful way. And when I say meaningful, it was a surprise to me to see my own definition of meaningful communication shift, because suddenly he started to really engage in the sensory world. And so he became very happy at, for example, I remember eating an orange. I remember just so vividly him smiling ear to ear at the pleasure of eating an orange. And I thought, what is going on here that he still has this sense of pleasure and engagement in life, even though the tools of his trade, his ability to communicate in what I thought were, you know, the meaningful linguistic ways, which has shifted obviously over time now, mm-hmm. how is that possible? And so that got me so fascinated. And that fascination has just grown over the years as I've seen so many of the different levels that people with memory issues and Alzheimer's exist on. The level of communication with language, and then the important level of communication at a soulful level or at the level of the senses.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that differentiation before. I wasn't really thinking about soulful as a sensory experience. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't thinking of, as soon as you said the example of the orange, that was interesting. So how did mm-hmm. you ultimately, now that you're further along the path, come to understand the relationship between that orange and his reaction and his deterioration?
The way I've come to understand that is that when the parts of the brain that are governed by conscious, planful thought related to our communication with language start to atrophy or deteriorate, there is a system that continues to exist related to our senses, and that circuitry is strongly related to limbic circuitry, which helps to govern that emotional response. And in fact, it's very helpful and empowering for caregivers of an individual with advanced memory issues to realize that when the language system might falter, that the communication with the senses can be a bastion of peace and an ability to really connect with that person. And so we talk a lot about what are the smells in that environment. You can manipulate those to bring a smile to that person's face. What are the foods that they're eating? What are they listening to? Simulated family presence, for example, the ability to have a recording of family member voices can be extraordinarily comforting. Music, the favorite music of that person. And then also touch. And so thinking about soft types of textures, et cetera. And so how I understand that is there's a whole system of sensory engagement that is a sort of a life preserver, so to speak, in terms of allowing us to continue communicating.
That is so interesting. You know, I really hadn't thought of the limbic system that way. You know, I did scans for a long time. We still do scans with SPECT imaging. And what happens is, of course, you can see it glowing, sort of hypertrophically glowing because of the increased blood circulation when a person has a problem with the limbic system, ironically enough. And we've always looked at it as a system that's tied up with depression and arrested feelings in a way where a person's locked down with something that's troubling them. And it's interesting to hear about this perspective, because here's a situation where it's stimulated, but it's in a way, forgiving for being somewhat, you know, simplistic about it, but it's their functional experience with reality. It's their lifeline in a way.
Absolutely. Right. And so I think that sense of communication often exists well beyond the spoken word, and family members are just so relieved to understand that. And we capitalize on that as much as possible to provide those moments of connection.
That is so interesting. So then one of the things you would encourage, I'm sure, would be ways to stimulate that in individuals who were suffering. And that would be part of a treatment program, which I had never heard of before.
Absolutely. And then also moving into the arts, there's a number of really great studies looking at music, dance, engaging in drawing and painting, and how that, again, transcends the linguistic communication, and how that can be so immersive for someone who has significant memory issues.
That's so interesting. So then let's take us along to this next level, because it sounds like you're interested in nootropics and how the brain can actually grow and how you can do things when it's developmentally arrested, if you will. But it's a physiologic, biologic, here's something we can do, folks. Let's talk about that. Approach that any way you want to, because I'm totally interested in it. I know our audience is as well.
Absolutely. I think that's the most exciting piece about what I've learned over time, is to understand that it was, I think, around 1998 when the field recognized that we are not born with all of the neurons we'll ever have, and that there was this hopeful recognition, we can actually create new neurons through some of the behaviors that we do, and in particular, cardiovascular exercise. And so one of the role models along those lines that I love to share the story about is Olga Kotelko. And Olga is an amazing person. She was from Canada, and she was a Ukrainian immigrant. And her parents, I think, had 10 children. And she had sort of she called herself a plain Jane, so to speak. And so she had this life that seemed sort of uneventful until she turned 65, at which time she started to play slow pitch softball of all games, and then later actually started to win track and field medals. And she started to win those around the age of 80 and ended up breaking 750 world records in track and field, 37 world records, and then won 750 medals. And so astounding. And she won those medals and did that until she was 95. And what was fascinating about Olga was she was also a giver. She gave of her time to her community, and she also wanted to share information about her brain functioning. So when she was 93, she went through a series of scans and neuropsychological tests. And what was found was that her hippocampus, which is about an inch and a half in, as you know, on either side, the shape of a curled thumb, and it's really the initial memory processing center for our brains, hers was larger than expected for her age, and also her white matter tracts. So in particular, the connection between both sides of the brain, or the corpus callosum, and then also the anterior cingulate, or the white matter bundle that's a little bit more in the frontal area that's connected with attention. Those areas were thicker than would be expected for her age as well. And it's unclear if exercise directly caused that, because we didn't have any baseline data on her, but her findings actually merge really well with some new research on what are called super agers. And so these are folks in their 60s to 80s who have memory and thinking skill function that is consistent with individuals who are decades younger, in some cases 18 to 35 year olds. Oh, and so that's really
term.
Amazing.
That's an interesting concept.
Yes, it is. And so with these groups, because a lot of times, again, we don't have that baseline data, we're not controlling the variables, we don't know exactly what's causing these amazing successes that they're experiencing. But when we look at their self-reports, when we look at their behavior, we find some commonalities. And those commonalities include physical exercise, intellectual engagement, actively engaging in their world, and oftentimes a nice social network where they're connected again to that larger community and that sense of purpose. And so if I had to, one of the things I've been doing for over 10 years now is exploring what are all of the factors that we know that are research supported that actually can enhance brain functioning and reduce our risk of Alzheimer's. And rising to the top of that list is cardiovascular exercise. And so we know, for example, that that helps individuals not only who are trying to minimize their risk in a preventative form, but also individuals even who have moderate Alzheimer's who engage in cardiovascular exercise can show enhanced memory function. So that's my big take-home tip for everybody, is the importance of that, because that is the...
Oh, that's interesting. You broke up a little
bit. Not online.
You broke up a little bit right there for some strange reason.
Sorry about that.
You were right at that important punctuation. Okay. I was thinking about a question. You broke up. If you could just repeat that last phrase you said.
Sure. So the take-home message here is that cardiovascular exercise is really the most powerful technique that we have. And also knowing that it's not online brain games or supplements or taking out a specific dietary food group. Those things can be sometimes helpful, but they certainly do not rise to the level of cardiovascular exercise.
That is so interesting. Okay, that was where I was going to ask the question, and then I didn't hear your punchline right there, but the question's still valid, and that is, what do you have a specific protocol in your research that is recommended? I mean, is this every day? Is three times a week? How could a person manage that in even a busy life, even if they're doggone 75?
Yes. It's nice to know that any amount helps, first of all. So that's the key. That's the key. The studies look at those who engage in cardiovascular exercise about 30 minutes, 4 to 5 days a week. And there are a couple of pieces that make it more effective. So variety is important. So engaging in different types of cardiovascular exercise, it might be walking one day, it might be dancing another day, or swimming, anything where you're getting that heart rate up. And I always like to add the caveat, under the direction of your healthcare provider. and knowing too that change is a nonlinear process of one step forward, two steps back. So I think even if it's 5 minutes a day, getting out there and just getting started is often the biggest step you can make. And then 5 minutes often automatically becomes 10, et cetera. So any amount is great.
You know, listeners, I have to tell you, this is, we've been in my practice, the people I work with, we've been interested in this subject for a long period of time. But this is really important information right here. And I want to just emphasize how important this is, because so many individuals are looking at so many different tracks of ways to do this. And Dr. Braun did tell us a couple of these things really quickly, nutraceuticals, diet, all those things are helpful. But she did say, and I'm emphasizing with her and for her, this exercise concept is really, really essential for individuals who wish to age gracefully. You don't have to have Alzheimer's to get this as meaningful and useful for your life. Even if you're not accustomed to exercising, you can still pull it off once you say, okay, I really don't want to age. I want to do something with myself.
Totally. And I love the fact that it's a home run. So it's not only taking our brain health and moving it to the next level, but the cardiovascular exercise is great for physical health, and in particular cardiovascular health. It's great for stress relief. It's great for sleep. It's great for mood. It's the number one treatment for mild to moderate depression. And so you're sort of hitting it out of the park when you do the cardiovascular exercise.
You hit all the bases and came all the way around. Yeah, that is very, very interesting. So, and I think the whole thing that we've seen so often is how often prescriptions, if you will, in the broader sense of the word, are for heart and for brain so effective. You know, it's like, okay, if you're going to do something for your heart, if you have had a cardiac hypertension, whatever the issue happens to be from a cardiovascular point of view, and you decide you're going to do something for it, how important that it is in terms of brain function in the end. Because those two those two bodies from a vascular point of view, they're taking the energy. They're growing. And as you point out, they're still moving along developmentally. So you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to just reiterate that I think that's such a great point, because those systems are so intertwined and interdependent. And so we think about the fact, for example, that a vascular risk factor, for example, diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, drastically increases the risk of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And also about the idea that people kind of stumbled on Alzheimer's dietary strategies through the back door of the DASH diet, which is about hypertension and looking at a diet that promotes better heart health. People were starting to go, hey, this is actually helping to slow cognitive aging. And so absolutely, those two systems are inextricably bound.
So let me ask you another question. I have to confess something. You don't know this about me, but I've been so interested in yet another somatic contribution to this question, which has to do with the gut and immunity, because we see so many people who are impaired, directly impaired, even as young people, by issues with the gut and the cytokines raining on the brain parade, actually blocking specifically the neurotransmitter receptors and causing brain function challenges, from cognitive disarray to depression. So how does that inflammatory piece and the bowel piece with immune system dysregulation fit into that larger picture of what we're talking about, cardiovascular and brain? Do you have any thoughts about that?
That's a great question. I think that we have a ways to go in examining that when it comes to the impact of inflammatory factors on the brain, because so many things can contribute to that inflammation. And I feel it's also really interesting to think about the fact that there are some neurons in the gut as well. And so that piece, I think, creates kind of a gateway where we need to continue looking at that relationship. And I think that that is such a fascinating area to look at, because there has been, as you're mentioning, some emerging research looking at that. And I think that I'm going to definitely be all ears as this comes forth, because if there's more that we can do to modulate that nutrition piece and the gut health piece, I want to help spread the word on that.
Well, it's so interesting, because it's been a real privilege just with Core Brain Journal. And I was telling you this sort of offhand before we got started, but the people I've had a chance to talk to are just amazing. I mean, I got to talk to this one guy who had a whole concept of meta-Darwinism, how Darwin was actually wrong, because it was talking about the survival of the species when it was really the microbiome causing the changes on a deeper level. And he's a very interesting guy. And then I talked to a number of people who look at these different aspects, including the microbiome as it's related to brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Now, let's ask, please, could you tell us, first of all, you're a neuropsychologist. I think that's an important differentiation, because a lot of our audience, and this is a little elementary, but, you know, the issue is, what is the difference between a neuropsychologist and a psychologist, if you don't mind?
That's a great question. So neuropsychologists and psychologists go through similar initial learning processes and pathways. So we go to graduate school, overall, if we look at undergrad plus graduate school, it's about 12 years of schooling, including postdoctoral work. And the neuropsychologist, though, sort of straddles the areas of psychology and medicine. And so, for example, I practiced most of my career in departments of neurology and neuroscience. And so the neuropsychologist has a specific expertise in brain behavior relationships and assessment. And so what I love about neuropsychological testing is that although it may look a little dated, because a lot of it is pencil and paper based, the results are as accurate and reliable as blood tests or neuroimaging, which is why it's so powerful in terms of its contributions to understanding a brain disorder. And also, there is always that popular misconception that we can diagnose a cognitive disorder by a brain scan. And we know that neuropsychological testing shows us that's not the case, because many times a brain can look riddled with atrophy or tissue loss, but the neuropsychological testing might be perfect and vice versa. So the neuropsych testing is a great tool for, I think of it as putting the brain on a test drive. So I look at a neuroimaging scan, like a head CT or a brain MRI, as you're looking at the outside of the car, but you can't tell how it runs. And then the neuropsychological testing is really getting behind the wheel and saying, okay, let's take a look at memory, problem solving, et cetera. So the neuropsychologist really just has that expertise in brain behavior relationships. And then it takes several years to add in terms of specialized educational placements and oftentimes placements in medical schools for the internship and postdoctoral fellowship.
See, that's so interesting. And I knew some of that, but I didn't. I think your comments about brain imaging are so well taken, because so many people see that picture and they want that picture to be the answer. And really, it's just a little bit of a step ahead of what I call the psychiatric fashion show, you know, where you label somebody by superficial appearances, and somehow that's going to be the thing you're going to throw medicine at, and the whole deal is over. And, you know, we don't really support that at all. And we have a page that the people who are really thinking about the future of mind science are really pretty much over the entire diagnostic manual, from the point of view that it's doesn't adequately address the biologic underpinning of brain function. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And you're saying that even SPECT imaging and functional MRI is really helpful. You're not disdaining it. That's interesting.
No.
But it doesn't accurately tell us sometimes what we can know by a very well done neuropsych testing. Now, Michelle, do you still do neuropsych testing?
Every day. So I see about 350 patients a year.
I didn't know if you were just teaching or what was going on, because you're so far into this. They're lucky to have you in town, I'm telling you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, the way you
explain I love serving the community. Yeah,
it'd be fantastic. So let's take that trip down the brain-derived neurotrophic factor lane and talk a little bit more about the brain health quiz and this high octane.
Yeah. So I define a high octane brain as a brain that operates at peak levels with regard to memory and thinking skills, and also has a reduced risk of Alzheimer's. So that's my attempt to add a little razzle dazzle to the brain health and make people a little bit more excited about it.
Yeah.
Because most people, if they can have a high octane brain, would want it. And I'm here to say it's possible if you engage in some of these research supported behaviors. And so chief among them, with that cardiovascular exercise, that's where the brain derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, really comes in, because that is the gardener, so to speak, for new neuronal growth. And the great thing about that is, if you could choose two brain locations and somebody said, okay, I'm going to give you a choice, any two brain locations you want where you want to have additional brain cells grow through BDNF, I personally would pick the hippocampus, which is, again, that core memory processing area. We have one on both sides of our brain, and little curled thumb-shaped structure, because that is really where memory is initially processed. And I also would pick the frontal lobes, because that's really central to our decision-making, our ability to create strategies and have great judgment about situations. And sure enough, that is exactly where BDNF does its work, in those two areas, which is amazing.
See, that is very interesting, because folks, some of you are innocents in this whole thing, and we're using some terminology that is not commonplace. It's not something you're going to talk about Saturday night at dinner. But honestly, we should be talking about it Saturday night at dinner. It's the reason we're doing Core Brain Journal, because what's going on is Dr. Braun is talking to us about absolutely essential points that are relevant globally. I mean, this whole brain deterioration thing is phenomenally challenging, and the economic impact, the societal impact is phenomenal. And this kind of thing is absolutely essential to be talking about. So let's go back and break down that metaphor of gardening for a moment, because that was the first time I'd heard gardening. I've often heard of BDNF as the fertilizer to grow the brain, but I'm interested in your thought about that, because gardening sounds a little more interesting from a metaphoric point of view, like the process rather than the objective. You know, it's gardening is an activity.
Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah, and I like to use that metaphor, because there's a gardener then, and that's us. And so, but you're absolutely right. You know, I think of the BDNF as well as really the seeds that we are creating with our action of doing the cardiovascular exercise. Mm-hmm. And so it's the protein essentially that results from that action that we take. And we as the gardener choose how much we're going to add into our system. And I think that that's extremely empowering to know that while a lot of other brain health strategies are designed to try to grow the connections between the neurons, it is only the BDNF that comes from the cardiovascular exercise that grows the seedlings of the new neurons themselves.
Okay, so now let's, that's great, because I was going to ask you that next question, is what is it and what does it really do? So part of the, what it does, it's a seedling that grows new neurons. And it,
right.
it's a protein.
Yes.
And how does it actually, mm-hmm. do you folks over on that side of the world know anything about how it actually does that?
That's a great question. I know that it is secreted in higher concentrations following cardiovascular exercise, and that can be looked at through serum levels, et cetera.
Oh, you can. I didn't realize that. You can, mm-hmm. You can actually draw some a BDNF and see what's going on.
Yeah, so there was a study actually that looked at individuals who were started on exercise programs and showed higher concentrations of BDNF then as a result of that.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I've seen pictures on YouTube, I honestly can't, it's a long time ago, where they had time-lapse photography of the brain cells actually growing over time under different circumstances. I'm sure because you do what you do, you've seen a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I'll have to actually look at that and see if I can find one of those to put in the show notes, because people would be interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other really interesting thing that this speaks to is the overall concept of cognitive reserve. And so I think of cognitive reserve as sort of our bank account that we're building over time of new neurons, but also the new connections between existing neurons that gives us greater density. So if the ravages and cellular changes of Alzheimer's come along and start eliminating some of the pathways that we have, we've got extra pathways to compensate. And so I feel, I like the idea that the BDNF side goes sort of hand in hand and in tandem with that process of trying to create new neuronal connections between existing neurons.
So it does that as well, because if you're, I'm asking this, I'm not telling you this because
sure.
This is all new to me in a certain respect. So by growing the neurons, you're actually growing more connections. So the neurons.
Well, I think of the BDNF as the central way of growing the new neuronal bodies. And I think of other behaviors that we do, such as brain exercise or intellectual engagement, as ways of growing the connections. So we're sort of piggybacking on the existing neuronal networks. And then we're saying, let's connect this side to this side through this activity. So I think of the distinction a little bit that way.
Thank you so much. That was a great explanation. I really appreciate it. So then now you're taking us into another dimension of doing everything we can to keep ourselves from aging too much. And that is, do you have any specific ideas about, for example, luminosity and some of these brain activities? Do they actually help with some of these things that you're talking about?
Not in a way that is as time sensitive as we could get with other activities. So they don't hurt, but they lack transfer to the real world. In other words, the main problem with those online games is that although you might get better at the game and your score might improve online, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to remember your grocery list any better or remember the name of a new person you met. Mm-hmm. And that's usually the whole point of why someone is engaging in those online brain games. And so that's the biggest concern from the clinical and scientific standpoint with those online brain games. The other thing I would say is that we know that it's not necessary to pay for something to grow those connections. For example, if you look at the Nunn study that's still ongoing, which is looking at over 675 nuns, we found, in the research, not me personally, but in terms of digesting the findings, that the nuns who engaged in the most daily activities, which included a variety of things that were very personalized, that could be visiting a museum, watching educational television, learning a second language, learning a new recipe. In other words, fill in the blank with whatever your interest is and notch it up at a level of difficulty, that they had the greatest resistance to Alzheimer's disease. So the way I like to tell people to operate when it comes to brain games, quote unquote, is to think of the world as your oyster when it comes to creating your own games. And you can create games, so to speak, through so many different activities that you enjoy by simply making them a little more challenging and, importantly, making them varied. So you want to do different things, and because that's going to grow different areas of connection. For example, you might take a new route to work. You might brush your teeth with your non-dominant hand. You might learn a new recipe. You might learn a new technique to garden, a second language. In other words, there's no limit or holy grail on a best activity, but it should be slightly challenging, varied, and it should be interesting. I've seen too many people get dragged into the office under shame of not doing their crossword puzzles. Mm-hmm. And those are only one of many tools that can be helpful.
See, I personally think fly fishing is the way to go, because you've got all the insects under the water, you've got the hatch, you got the fish, you got so many different places to fish, you got how you get there. Now, and I'm confessing that I love fly fishing, but I've been so busy I haven't been fly fishing enough. But that's very interesting, because that's a very strong and helpful suggestion for many people there. To again be too simplistic, is chasing your dreams as opposed to not chasing your dreams and watching TV or whatever. It's the opposite.
I totally agree. I think chasing your dreams and doing what you enjoy and what is bringing you a sense of fulfillment and purpose, and then just notching it up a little so that we're not just doing things that we're an expert at. So for me, that's navigating around the city. That doesn't come easily to me. So sometimes I put myself through little tests and make myself try to find the shortest distance between two places. But yes, operating in the real world, knowing what we need to strengthen ourselves, it's empowering and it makes us do the task more.
Now, we want to send a long distance high five to Michelle, because she's too young to be worrying about these things. But she's saying, look, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm forming the habits right now as a young woman, and I'm going to get this done. I'm going to practice it. I'm going to practice what I preach. I'm going to do it right now. So, good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good job on your part. So,
thank you.
Let me ask you this now: have you written a book? We have this brain health quiz, and you've been reporting and talking about these things. Are you in the process of writing something? I didn't quite get that point.
Yeah, I am actually in the process of writing a book on brain health and how to develop a high octane brain. And for me, it's really important, because these issues are habit and lifestyle changes that are innately difficult to make. We've got to make it fun, because we need people to engage in this. You're right. You know, this is a tidal wave coming. We've got 76 million baby boomers. 10 million, unfortunately, have been projected to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which is going to be double the amount of people that are diagnosed currently. And when those baby boomers talk through surveys, they are saying Alzheimer's is our number one concern. It's our number one fear. So my book, as it's evolving, is really aiming to combine the science with the fun, the empowerment, the metaphors, the engagement that's necessary to bring this to a level that people are actually going to get excited about using it.
Sounds very, very interesting. I'm looking forward to having you back as soon as it comes out. because it'll be fun to try to help you get it out there and have additional conversations as we think about this. It's very, very interesting. So you're going
to... Yeah, I can't wait.
When what's your plan on it? Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you. What's your plan?
The plan should be I'm working with some folks on it right now. I'm hoping to get it out hopefully in the next year or so. Mm-hmm. And really trying to make it cutting edge and bringing in all of the new research and really trying to simplify all of the findings that are out there so that it's digestible and empowering. And the goal really is to save people time and money, because there's nothing more concerning to me than seeing people not optimizing their time when it comes to something as important as brain health and doing things that are minimally helpful, but are really not giving them the catapulted boost that they need.
Well, and you think about the cost of domiciliary care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've worked their entire lives and they want to give something to their children, and they are going to live longer because we are living longer. We can take care of some of those biomedical necessities to actually take our body down the road further. But if our body's going but our brain isn't cooking, then we're going to not be living in a situation that we can take care of. We're going to have to be paying somebody to take care of us. And that is the problem. And it's great insurance for your family to take care of yourself at an early age.
Yeah, and I love that idea of thinking about it as a way of caring for your family, because so many of us, when push comes to shove, it's our families who are very important to us. And it is an extreme act of family care and self-care to prioritize this. It's especially interesting to note that by the time Alzheimer's is diagnosed, it's been brewing in many people for 10 to 20 years. And so there's so much time that we can really harness and engage with our families as we do these brain health strategies. So we can involve them in the process too. It's never too early or too late.
Well, Michelle, I could talk to you for a long time. It's so interesting hearing you talk, because we're really on the same path. And the way you're thinking is so preventative. I mean, this isn't, okay, the whole thing is wrecked, how do we rebuild it? This mm-hmm. is how do we keep from having the accident. I mean, this is putting safety belts on. Mm-hmm. It's like getting the car filled with gas before you take off, you know, to Timbuktu, whatever. So you take care of yourself. And really, that's where medicine is going, is how do we actually fix these things before they happen? And we really, really appreciate you coming on board. And I really do look forward to talking with you about your book. So let's talk about, we'll just get in a little piece of your website, and we'll get the spelling of your last name. So it's Dr. Michelle, Braun.
Yes, that's right.
That for everybody. And that's going to be on the show notes. So is there anything in closing that you want to say, Michelle, as we wind up, that might be sort of a punctuation point that you think you'd like to share as we close?
Just, I'm happy to have this opportunity because I want to share the exciting, empowering information that's out there. Mm-hmm. And I want people to feel like they can walk away with something that they can use immediately and something that's going to benefit them. And I'm excited because the science has come to the point where we can finally share that information. And I'm just hoping everyone goes out and acts on this, even if it's just a couple minutes. That would make me so excited. So I just being here to share that message is a joy.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's a different reality. When you have the science like this, it takes us to a different reality. And denial is not, when you face reality, denial melts away. Here it is. Let's get it done. So mm-hmm. thank you very much, Michelle. Great talking to you. You have a great evening out there in Wisconsin, girl.
Thank you. You too.
All right. We'll see you. Thanks for listening to CoBrain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications like those written for ADHD are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.